This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This is another Bits and Pieces episode. Here's what we have this time. Sean Mobley from the Museum of Flight in Seattle, Washington, has several clips from their new podcast. Launchpad Marzari speaks with Jim DiMatteo, the race director for Red Bull Air Race. Our main man, Micah, has a tale he calls New Year's Dad. I have an update on the Eat at the Airport project. Launchpad Marzari comes back to talk with Captain Skip Lucier, the Navy pilot who flew President George W. Bush to the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln. Dave Homewood from the Wings Over New Zealand show brings us a history segment on the de Havilland Mosquito. And David Vanderhoof recorded a session at the Smithsonian's Airbus IMAX Theater with Dr. Ellen Stofan, the new director of the National Air and Space Museum. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 533 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. As is our tradition, when a U.S. holiday falls on Monday, when we normally record the show, we take the week off. Except we gather up some pre-recorded segments from the co-hosts, from contributors, and you, our listeners, and create what we call a Bits and Pieces episode. That's the case this time, as we spend New Year's Eve with our friends and families. We have some great segments for you this episode. Some are a little bit long, and you can find time codes in the show notes if you need to navigate about the episode. So, let's get started with Sean Mobley from the Museum of Flight in Seattle, Washington. He's the host of the museum's Flight Deck podcast, and he has two clips from that show. Here's Sean.
Hello there to all the listeners of the Airplane Geeks podcast. My name is Sean Mobley from the Museum of Flight in Seattle, Washington. We are located on Boeing Field just south of downtown Seattle and are one of the world's largest nonprofit private air and space museums. We're home to the number one Boeing 747, the only MD-21 Blackbird left in existence, one of only three Concorde airliners in the United States, the Red Barn, which is the original Boeing factory, so much stuff here at the museum. And beyond that, beyond our planes and our spacecraft, we're very proud of our extensive education programs, both in person here at the museum and sent out digitally and in person all around the world. The kind folks at the Airplane Geeks podcast have been very gracious to let me, the host of the Museum of Flight's own brand new podcast called The Flight Deck, play a few clips from our show for their Bits and Pieces episode. And thank you so much to them for their generosity. I have two clips to play for you today. This first one is an unreleased piece of audio from an episode that hasn't come out yet, so you are going to hear it before anyone from the Museum of Flight hears it. It'll be coming out a little bit later in 2019. The Museum of Flight has a MiG-21, and the story of how the museum managed to get this plane is almost as interesting as the plane itself. We got this in the early 1990s as the Soviet Empire dissolved, as the result of a fortuitous visit to the newly born Czech Republic by Boeing employee Jim Blue. Now, it's a common misconception that the Museum of Flight is the Boeing Museum. We are not affiliated with the Boeing Company, though they are generous supporters of the museum. But this story is an example of how Boeing still runs through our DNA. Museum of Flight docent Bruce Florsheim has the story.
Now, it was the end of the Cold War, and the Berlin Wall had fallen. A Boeing vice president named Jim Blue was on a business trip to Eastern Europe. At Aerovodochody, the largest aircraft manufacturer in the Czech Republic, Jim spotted 69 MiG-21 fighters sitting under tarps outside the Aero factory. Jim asked his host, "Well, what's going to become of these airplanes? The Cold War is over. You don't need them anymore." The host said, "Well, they're designated to be scrapped." Now, Jim, who was a trustee of the Museum of Flight, thought it'd be a great aircraft to have in Seattle. So he asked his host if the Czechs would consider selling one of these MiG-21s to the museum. The Czechs declined, saying, "No, not possible. Top secret." But Jim kept badgering him. Finally, the Czechs conceded they might be able to sell a MiG-21 to the Museum of Flight, but announced that the price would be $15,000, a figure that the Czechs thought would stop Jim dead in his tracks and shut him up for good. Instead, Jim pulled out his personal checkbook and wrote the Czechs a check for $15,000. He was now the proud owner of a Russian MiG-21.
It'd be a fun one to call the wife and say, "Hey." So what happened next?
Well, back in Seattle, about 2 weeks later, Jim got a telephone call from the Czechs informing him that they had given him the wrong price. Fearing that the Czechs were going to add a zero or two to the price, Jim was stunned to hear that the correct price was only $10,000. Not only that, but Arrow would include a Tamansky turbojet engine that had just been overhauled to zero-time status. In short, Jim would get a zero-time fighter airframe with a zero-time engine and get a $5,000 refund. But there was a problem. As I mentioned, the MiG-21 has a maximum range of about 1,000 miles. There was no way to have that airplane flown to Seattle unless you happen to have a Russian refueling airplane. And Jim didn't have one of those.
Yeah, it might be a bit more zeros.
Yes. Now, Boeing test pilots thought that they had a way to fly the MiG to Seattle, but it was deemed so risky that the insurance costs would make it prohibitively expensive. So the airplane had to be disassembled, put into crates, put aboard a ship, taken through the Panama Canal, then up the west coast to the port of Seattle. From there, it had to be trucked to the Museum of Flight and reassembled. Now, that would cost tens of thousands of dollars more. Jim was a rich guy, but not that rich. So Jim called on his friends in the Boeing Management Association, and we helped raise the money. A special shout-out to Del Hoffman, Bob Bogash, and the Jim Blue MiG-21 acquisition team.
Of which you are a member.
Yes.
One of the first aircraft visitors to the Museum of Flight's Great Gallery will see is the Boeing Model 40B. Now, this plane has quickly become one of my personal favorite aircraft since I started working here because, to me, it represents the transition of aviation in the U.S. from hauling airmail to hauling passengers. In 1927, the same year Charles Lindbergh forged the path over the Atlantic, Jane Eads, a young journalist from Chicago, flew the other direction and forged another path pretty much as important, proof that planes could not only safely cross the Atlantic, but could also make transcontinental trips safely carrying passengers on board. Museum of Flight docent Zandria Hopper shared Jane Eads' story along with some reading from Jane Eads' own original articles in 1927. Was this a dangerous trip? Was she taking her life into her own hands by doing this?
You know, when we read her articles, she alternates between fear and terror and absolute wonder. One of her more poetic comments was actually about the engine when she said, "Directly in front of me is the secret of the speed and safety. It's the Pratt & Whitney Wasp 9-cylinder air-cooled motor that is used in all 25 Boeing planes now in operation on the Chicago to San Francisco route." Pilot Ira O. Biffle, the man who, by the way, gave Slim Lindbergh his first lesson on aviation controls, shouted a few words to surrounding mechanics. The huge motor roared to life as it began developing its more than 400 horsepower. We swung out blithely and sped onward, making 95 miles per hour. It was the most exhilarating feeling I've experienced in all my life.
Now, when you say passenger cabin, that conjures up images of first-class plush seats and bathrooms and
it's funny,
flight,
you know,
attendants.
Exactly. You know, it's funny. She described it as luxury, luxurious. And, you know, if we got
looking at it, I would not agree.
No, I agree with you on that one. That is completely true. The plane itself, if you're looking at it from the side,
not very big, first of all.
No, it's not very big. It's a biplane, and it's got this huge radial engine mounted on the front. And right behind the engine compartment is the passenger compartment. It's not very big. It's difficult to get in and out of. Of course, there was no pressurization at the time. And so you were really at the mercy of the altitude that you were flying in. You were also at the mercy of the temperature. We didn't have insulation or any kind of temperature controls. It was not comfortable, but she was comfortable enough. And the only thing she said that she wished was that she had packed more lunch for herself. She had and was really wishing for a cup of coffee, but she would have to wait until their next landing in order to get that need satisfied. And behind the passenger compartment was where all the mail was carried. And then behind that was the pilot, and he was sitting outside. When she's describing flying, when she can see the stars, and she says, "The stars are out now. There are millions of them sprinkled about the heavens. The sky is much lighter than the earth, which looks vaguely sinister. I feel uncertain as to the depths the darkness below seems to hold. And if I were falling, I'd rather fall up than down. We are flying higher than at any time since we started. Beacon lights here and there along the route are leading us on. They are lighting the way to a new era."
Thank you so much for listening. And thanks again to the hosts of the Airplane Geeks podcast for this opportunity to share some stories from the Museum of Flight with all of you. I hope you'll come and visit us here in Seattle in 2019. We have some amazing things happening this year. Big one, obviously, recognition of the 50th anniversary of the moon landings. Some extremely special exhibits around that, along with the completion of a B-52 Vietnam Veterans Memorial Park that will be part of the museum campus. That and so much more. Check out the museum online at museumofflight.org. And if you want to hear more stories like this from the museum, please check out the museum podcast at museumofflight.org/podcast. This is Sean Mobley saying we'll see you out there, folks.
Again, you can find the Museum of Flight online at museumofflight.org. And you can also find the podcast, Flight Deck Podcast, at that site. Now we have Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. He spoke with Jim DiMatteo, the race director for the Red Bull Air Race.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. Today we are here with somebody really special. I'm here with
Jim DiMatteo, the race director for Red Bull Air Race.
And we've just finished up the season with the most spectacular race.
Yeah, no, it was super exciting. I think any time, any sport, regardless of baseball, football, basketball, car racing, whatever, any time a world championship can be sighted on the last play, the last second, the last shot, the last race in this case, on the last pylon, that's just super exciting for the sport, and we're really happy how 2018 ended up.
We're the Airplane Geeks, so let's get geeky for a moment. What telemetry are the aircraft sending you?
So in race control, which is basically the CIC, the information center, if you will, of the entire event, we have really kind of two groups in there. One is the aviation side and one is the event production side. So from a telemetry side, what the planes are sending me or the aviation group that's in race control, items that we think about from safety and aviation perspectives, but then also from a sporting perspective. And so the telemetry that comes to us that we use, that we take immediately, that would go into a judging scenario would be G and airspeed. So we get immediate indication of an over-G situation, and we get, of course, their airspeed throughout the entire race.
You're getting airspeed. Where are you getting the airspeed from?
It's actually from the GPS side of positional data, if you will. If you look at how elaborate our ghost track is,
right,
that's really what has sophisticatedly advanced our positional data, because we want that to be super, super accurate, right? We want that to make sure that if you're looking at it and we're using it from a spectator's perspective as a who's winning, who's losing.
Right, we've
type
seen the ghost
scenario.
Image. Seen the ghost images that you project.
Exactly. So that ghost image, it's real critical from a credibility perspective that that's accurate, right? You don't want in real life for the plane to fly through the finish gate and then the ghost vector to come in second, but then all of a sudden the guy behind actually has the faster time. That would really damage the credibility of the whole system. So a lot of effort and time and expense, et cetera, has gone to that positional data. And so that actually what is also what helps calibrate all of our other airspeed, G-force, all that type of stuff is coming from this super complex G-Wiz box called a PRU that's in the aircraft.
All right. So the pilot, though, has to be on his skill part. He's flying off of indicated airspeed. So he's having to calibrate that and fly indicated.
He's seeing the same thing we're seeing.
Oh.
So we have a screen. He's not just looking at a pneumatic airspeed indicator in his plane. He's looking at a digital readout that's exact same as us. So, again, from a sporting perspective, we don't want him to be looking at something different than us. We want everybody to be looking at the exact same number. So the big screen that's – and they can set it up differently depending on the pilot, what his desires are, just like a heads-up display in a fighter. You can pick and choose how you want certain things done in the G-Force lights, et cetera. So that's where the pilot has some choice, but he's looking at the exact same number that we're looking at in all of his data.
How are you transmitting that from the aircraft to the ground? Is that X, you know, what part of the spectrum, different radio? What are you doing?
Yeah, you know, you're getting out of my level of expertise. That's our technical group that is actually the ones that are on, that are putting the boxes in the airplanes. All I know as the race director is that it's accurate. It's exactly what the pilot is looking at. It goes into this fancy box, and then this fancy box sends it down to my screen, and then I get to evaluate what's going on and then judge both from what I see outside in addition to what I see digitally.
Okay, now as the race director, are you acting as the air boss, or does the air boss work for you? How is that?
So we call it a race director in the Red Bull Air Race. And I'm responsible if you're trying to compare it to something like an air show, there's an air boss function to my job. So air boss is part of what I do in the sense of I am controlling the air side of things. But in addition to that, I also have a safety hat on from a sporting perspective and a sporting hat on in the sense that the judges are assisting me and I'm calling somebody, knock it off. All those different calls that I'm making that would be in addition to an air boss job. An air boss, a typical air boss at an air show, is really just handling the airborne aviation side of things and not a sporting thing.
Right. And I was thinking more toward who's channeling that, you know, clearing people to get them onto the runway, because our runway's right here in the event, and then putting them out in the staging area and telling them.
So we kind of divided up a little bit in what we call on race control frequency and then grid control frequency. I have a group of individuals that are on what we call grid control. And what grid control really is analogous from an aviation perspective to like ground control. So in a scenario like we have here at Texas Motor Speedway, we coexist. But this is not how we always are. So today,
which is why this makes it a superior venue for us, the fans, because we can see both the air landings and takeoffs as well as the track.
Fantastic. I mean, when we're co-located, it's the absolutely most exciting part for the spectators because you see everything. You see the mechanics working on the planes. You see the pilots prepping themselves mentally, you know, and physically for the race. You see the planes getting pushed out. You see the start. You see the takeoff. You see the race. And, of course, you see the landing and then their emotions when they get out of the plane. You really see everything. So it's premier, it's fantastic in a setup like this. But we don't always have this opportunity, especially obviously when we are flying a lot around water or over water. Often the the runway that we land on is 10 miles away. And so we have the system exactly set up where my grid control here, there's three of them, and they were right, 5 feet to my left. In the last race in Kazan, they were 12 miles away. And so we still operate the exact same way through our radios as far as communication, and we integrate the timing in that manner. I have what we call a show caller. Because we're televised in 187 countries around the world, it's super critical that the live TV product is properly timed. And so that show caller is giving me timing cues. So he will tell me 60 seconds, 30 seconds. And then I'm looking basically from an Airbus perspective. I'm looking at the overall track. Is the track ready? Can I bring him in? Where is he? What turn, is he inside, outside of his turn? Then I'll coordinate that. I'll bring the guy in. Then I'll say, 99 Gulen, you're clearing the track, smoke on. And the smoke on call, my background is I've been a career Navy fighter pilot. I was also a landing signal officer. And as an LSO, we have a code word where we say Roger Ball. And Roger Ball is really a word that means, or two words that mean a lot of things. First, it means I'm establishing two-way communications with the pilot. You're cleared to land. The flight deck is set for you. The arresting gear is set for you. Everybody, when they hear Roger Ball, then they're cued to do their individual jobs of what they're supposed to do. And that's kind of the exact same way we came up with smoke on. Smoke on means, of course, yes, turn your smoke on. But also it means you're cleared in the track. The track is clear. We have a hot box. We're ready to race. You're cleared to race. And it tells other people that are hearing and listening to me to start to do their roles and their activities that they have to do.
The photo ship, the individual gate crews, the individual cameramen.
Exactly right. So that's kind of it's turned into a hashtag. Smoke on is kind of a buzzword that we use from a marketing perspective as well. But really from an aviation perspective, it's a phrase that keys a lot of initiatives that have to be done by individuals.
Okay. Now let's talk about you as a race director. Did you have to go to like Airboss school at ICAS?
It's funny that you say that. So I've been the race director for the last 10 years or 11 or 12 years now. Before the Airboss school, if you will, really existed. This is very different and unique from a typical air show Airboss requirement. That being said, I am a member of the board of directors for ICAS, and so I'm very, very cognizant with about the new requirement in the 8900 that's coming next year and the Airboss training and Airboss certification program. I actually, at the Miramar Air Show 2 months ago, went through the Airboss training program with ICAS's program, kind of as a to test it, but to go through it, to evaluate it, to give feedback on it, and to also see if I could assist in some way. It's unique. We don't have to. The Red Bull Air Race itself is a unique situation. Yeah. So FAA is. I would be the one who taught the course, so I wouldn't. It's not that the ICAS Airboss Academy is going to teach me with regard to Red Bull Air Race, because that's very unique. But what you probably see at an air race is we have side acts. So in between the races, I will have airborne side acts that come through. And from that perspective, we are kind of implementing the ICAS Airboss rules, if you will. And so that part of it, I am kind of acting as an air boss in FAA eyes that is coordinating and legally producing this aviation side act.
Speaking of FAA eyes, is there a set here in the stadium with us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everywhere we go in the world, we deal with some kind of aviation authority. Everywhere we go, We have our little bubble that we do things inside our bubble, but that has to be approved by the local and country's regulatory body. In addition, the coordination of our little bubble, how we go in and out. So
you're talking about the TFR.
It's a TFR.
In U.S., it'd be a TFR.
Right. Here, it's a TFR, and I have established a TFR over Texas Motor Speedway. But sometimes, you know, wherever we go, we operate in this little bubble. But that's if we're co-located where the airport is. Because often we're not. Right. And so if we're 10 miles away, then those individuals have to take off, fly to our racetrack, our little bubble, do our race, and then fly back. And so we coordinate with local aviation authorities. We coordinate with air traffic controllers. Do we squawk? Do we not squawk?
I was going to ask that. That implies if you leave the bubble, if you leave the TFR, what are we squawking? Are we going to be, and next year, you're going to be ADS-B compliant?
Yeah, all of that stuff is a requirement, correct. We do have to, from a squawk perspective, if we are co-located airport and air race, like we are right here, right now, where the plane just takes off, goes right in the track and lands, then we won't squawk. If we are especially near aircraft, airliners especially, that are flying overhead, because we don't want to throw, you know, their TCAS into a collision avoidance requirement that they're bound and legally have to do. So what we'll do is we will turn our squawk off. The scenarios where we take off and have to transit for 10 miles and then come into a box, obviously all of those we do squawk. And so that scenario is slightly different. If there is a, we typically don't want to have the pilots adjust something. We just want them to set it, because I really want them to get in a mindset of, once I've committed to racing,
I'm racing. I'm not flying.
Right, and it's, you got to get into the race mode and mentally and physically and emotionally and, you know, just their thinking ahead of the aircraft, because these gates are coming about every 2 seconds, and so you really got to be flying ahead of the aircraft. And so we take off almost all the time, unless there's a ground start. We take off, we go into what we call a holding position, and in that holding position, they're really getting themselves prepared to come into the track.
Here at Texas, was your holding positions inside the TFRs?
It was just on the north side of it, so it was close. I limited the TFR because of the request of the, we work with them.
Right.
And here it was a 2 mile radius, and it was specifically a 2 mile radius because there is an airport, a small civilian airport just northeast of us at about 3 miles. And then you have Alliance Airfield to the south of us. And I didn't want to, impact the small airport by putting them inside the TFR, so we stopped it just,
you know, and us general aviation pilots, thank you.
Absolutely. And at the same time, I didn't want to cross the runway centerline approach of Alliance, and so that's why I used a 2 mile radius. That being said, most of us as aviators, if you see something that says a TFR that has popped up, you typically just avoid that area. For example, Alliance in Fort Worth air traffic control personnel with us, and if they saw somebody coming near us, they would identify it, traffic to us within our, you know, even if he's kind of scooting next to the TFR.
Now, as a member of EAA and a Young Eagle mentor pilot, how do we leverage this to get people excited about aviation?
So as a professional naval aviator and then also a general aviation guy myself, I'm passionate about aviation. My dad and my older brother are both naval aviators, and my brother also was a commercial airline pilot, or is a commercial airline pilot. And so aviation is in my blood, and it has been from when I was a young kid. I also was up at Oshkosh and ran the Features and Attractions, the air show at AirVenture for 3 years, so intimately familiar with the pilot shortfalls that are coming and looming in our future. Anything that we can do to excite and motivate and help younger people get involved in aviation, not only is something that I'm passionate about, but it's also it's a necessity for us going forward. Younger kids today are kind of drawn in a lot of different areas that are still exciting stuff. So it's how do we get them excited in naval, in aviation as a whole?
Said it.
I almost said naval aviation, yeah. But aviation as a whole. Red Bull Air Race combines the excitement of aviation with a brand association of Red Bull. Red Bull is a cool brand for young people, period. If a 20-year-old kid hears, hey, there's a Red Bull party somewhere, he knows that's a cool party. He doesn't have to know anything else about it other than because Red Bull is exciting and it's a youthful brand. And so when we associate our industry of aviation with a cool, youthful brand, that's a very, very positive thing for us in the aviation community to excite and motivate people, young people, to get involved in aviation, not just as a pilot, but you could be a technician. You could be involved in any aspect of the aviation world. And we're trying to motivate them through the brand association of a really cool, youthful brand like Red Bull. At a Red Bull Air Race event, we see a ton of teenagers in 20 in somethings and, you know, 30 somethings. And so to me, that's very exciting because it's guys and gals that are at a decision in their life of about what career paths to go down. And if we can excite them about the aviation world, then that benefits all of us that are passionate.
Well, Jim, thank you. If they want to know more, where would they go?
Go visit www.redbullairrace.com and check out our website. It's a really nice website, and you'll have all the information that you could ever want to know. And there's also technical aspects. Our technical director Jimbo Reed, he loves talking technical stuff, and so go check him out on our website, and I know you'll enjoy it.
Well, there you go, Airplane Geek listeners. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Thank you, Launchpad. Now, Micah brings us a story that he calls New Year's Dad.
The new year comes twice a year for me. Of course, there's this time of year, the first day of January, for the year we all know. But there's also the first day of Tishrei, the Jewish New Year, called Rosh Hashanah. While there's a joy to the Jewish New Year, it's more of a time for self-examination and repentance, a 10-day process that ends with the holiday of Yom Kippur. So I started to write this just as Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement, had ended. It had been a week of reflection since Rosh Hashanah. And while this little piece was started at the beginning of the Jewish New Year, it's just as applicable for this secular New Year. When I started writing this, it had just turned 5779 according to the Hebrew calendar. I just couldn't get used to it. I'd been writing 5778 on all my checks, but eventually I got over it. The thing that I didn't, and won't get over, though, probably for the rest of my life, is that I miss my dad. Lou Engber, NCO in the Army Corps of Engineers during World War II, first lieutenant in the Medical Corps of the U.S. Air Force during the Korean conflict, a brilliant psychologist, terrific raconteur, bibliophile, pulp fiction, Western, and science fiction fan, trivia expert, a gourmet, and at times a gourmand, an airplane geek, beer connoisseur, but most important to me right now, my father. He's the man who taught me not so much all I know, but kind of how to know it. He shaped my tastes, my likes and loves, probably unwittingly and unintentionally, but nonetheless, most certainly. Perhaps more importantly, he taught me how to learn for myself, how to love and appreciate learning itself, and loved to pass on my knowledge to others. It wasn't just the high holy days that had me missing my dad, although that may have been the impetus. There's another thing that had me thinking of him. You see, it was also the time of the year when the Collings Foundation makes an almost annual trip to the Jetport here in Portland, Maine, PWM. This year, it was the Wings of Freedom Tour, including the B-24J Liberator, Witchcraft, the B-25 Mitchell, Tondaleo, and the TF-51D Mustang, Toulouse Nuts. The B-17G Flying Fortress, 9 of 9, was stuck in Vermont, having just gone tech. Yeah, I missed the B-17, but I was missing my dad even more. You see, I grew up with all these aircraft. Well, not these exact airplanes, but these types are similar. It was talking about aircraft, ships, science fiction, and other common interests that I shared with my dad that helped make us close. You often hear about baseball bringing fathers and sons together. Well, for me and my dad, it wasn't baseball. It was aircraft, and flying, among others. Quite a few other things. I was fortunate. What am I saying? I am fortunate. You know, many men of my father's generation weren't able to share their feelings. Their feelings would come out in other ways. My dad and I shared feelings indirectly through aircraft. That's not the fortunate part, though. The fortunate part is, maybe through his training as a psychologist, my dad could share a bit better than some others of his generation. Saying the words, "I love you, son," weren't difficult for him, so there was never any doubt. Sometimes it was more difficult for me to say it back to him, but I'm fully confident that he knew how I felt and still feel about him. We would often take museum trips together. We lived right outside of New York City, so we weren't strangers to the American Museum of Natural History, the Hayden Planetarium, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Being close to West Point as well, we would travel up there often. We visited Annapolis a couple of times and got to the old Rhinebeck Aerodrome twice. We were familiar with the USS Ling and once made it to the USS Intrepid early on in her career as a museum ship. We also made it to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum on the Mall together once. Jeez, we even got to visit the U.S. Air Force Academy together when I lived in Colorado. Thinking back on it, we only saw two air shows together. There was one tiny one in Athens, Ohio, sometime between 1981 and 83, and then one big one in Pueblo, Colorado in 1985. Pueblo was the first time either one of us got to see the Thunderbirds. What a great experience it was to see the U.S. Air Force's official air demonstration team for the first time with another airplane geek and USAF veteran who had never seen them before either. When that someone else also happens to be your father, well, what can I say? But, you know, as wonderful as the great State of Colorado air show was to see with my dad, the little one in Athens, Ohio is more illustrative of who he was and the kind of relationship we had. Like I said, it was a tiny air show. Mostly GA aircraft on display, as well as Ohio University's two DC-3s that I've told you about before. They weren't flying, but this was the first time my dad and I got to see a DC-3 in person together. There was an interesting helicopter demonstration put on by the local U.S. Forest Service. It was a firefighting display done by a small two-seat helicopter that slung a big canvas bucket underneath it as it flew. It went to and from a lake near the airport and showed how effective it can be in dousing wildfires. The real amazing thing for me, though, was the Ford Tri-Motor. Based in Port Clinton, Ohio, it was recently taken out of regular freight and passenger service and was giving sightseeing tours over Lake Erie. It flew down to Athens specifically for the air show and was offering rides. We'd watch it take off and come back a few times as we walked through the static displays. You know what else? Airplane Geek's friend, Bill Barry, chief NASA historian, recently got some stick time in the right-hand seat of that very aircraft. Anyway, after a while, my dad lit up a cigar. Back then, it wasn't really unusual to smoke publicly, even on an airfield. He loved cigars, and was and had been a real cigar aficionado all his life. At that point, Cuban cigars weren't available in the USA, and he was smoking mostly Dominican tobacco that he bought by the box of 50. This was long before cigars became popular, and the ones he smoked back then would go for $50 or $60 a piece based on today's cigar economy. Anyway, he lit up his cigar and said, "So, would you like to take a ride on the Tri-Motor?" Now remember, I was at least 25 years old then. I don't remember exactly, but I lit up like a little boy. "Sure," I said, "let's go." My dad said that he'd rather stay on the ground, enjoy his cigar, and relax. He smoked big cigars, and they would last him about 45 minutes. He handed me the $35 for a ticket and told me to go have a good flight. I was a little disappointed to go by myself, but not at all reluctant. I took the cash, bought my ticket, and had a wonderful flight. I wish I were a camera guy, as I have no photos. Nothing but faded memories of rattan seats, a high wing, loud engines, and a low-altitude flight that was all too short. When I got back down, my dad asked me how it was. I remember telling him all about it, and I can see his face and smile in my mind now as I think about it. We left not too long after that and went back to town for some terrific Mexican food and beers at Casa Que Pasa. Then we headed to my regular hangout bar, Mr. Bojangles, where my favorite Newgrass band, the New Vinton County Frogwompers, Marching, Singing, Strumming, and a Plucking Society Incorporated were playing. It was a great day. But remember, I said this little air show in Athens, Ohio, was illustrative of the kind of relationship my dad and I had? Well, here's why. And understand, it's only recently that I've come to realize this part of it all. Remember I said my dad lit up a cigar and then asked me if I wanted to go fly on the Ford Trimotor and then handed me the $35 for a ticket? Well, back then, $35 was a lot of money. I certainly didn't have that kind of cash to spend on a joyride. My dad had never flown on a Ford Trimotor before, and never did before he passed, but he wanted to make sure I had the experience. I'm pretty sure he lit that cigar first on purpose, because he really didn't have the cash for two tickets, yet wanted to give me, his son, that thrill and not have to talk about the money. It's only now, on reflection, that I realize he did it as a way to bow out gracefully and still give me, his airplane geek son, a flying experience I would never forget. That's the kind of guy he was. So yes, while this story was started just after the Jewish New Year, it's still a holiday story, or maybe a story for any time. So thanks, Dad. Thanks for everything. And know, whenever I go to a museum, drink a great beer, see an airplane, and countless other things, I think of you, and I miss you. For the Airplane Geeks here in Portland, Maine, Happy New Year from your Maine man, Micah.
Eat at the airport. Now, this started out as a simple idea. You see, I eat out a lot, probably too much. But I thought, you know, a lot of GA airports have a restaurant or a diner, someplace to eat. So why not help support the local airport and eat there? So I started doing that. And along the way, I sort of had a vision in my head of a map with pins for the airports that I went to and ate at. Just sort of a record, but then it kind of expanded to something that might be useful for more people. Not just pilots, but also land travelers and people who are on road trips and need a place to eat. Well, a map with pins on it showing these locations might be helpful to find a great place to eat, someplace where you could support the airport. Well, it turns out that it's pretty easy to make a custom Google map with your own pins. So I started doing that, marking off some airports and noting the restaurants that were there. Well, as I was doing that, I just had to check and see if eatattheairport.com was available. And guess what? It was. So I logged into my Hover account, and within about 90 seconds, I owned eatattheairport.com. Of course, I needed a place to house this map, so I just made a page on the Airplane Geeks website and had eatattheairport.com redirect to that page. And then it was relatively simple to embed the map showing the airports and the restaurants onto that page. I think the whole thing elapsed time was maybe 20 minutes at most. It was really pretty simple. The thing about the internet is, you know, it encourages impulsive people to do impulsive things, and that's kind of what this was. So then I started asking folks to contribute, and I did that in our Slack team and amongst some other readers, and people started sending in airports with restaurants, and I thought, well, yeah, this is too labor-intensive. I need a way, well, at least where people could submit sites easily. So I found a WordPress plugin, a free one, that does forms on your WordPress website. So with that, I hacked together just a quick, simple form. That only took a few minutes. So where are we now? All right, so if you go to eatattheairport.com, you end up on an Airplane Geeks page, but that's fine. And you'll see the map, and you can zoom in and move around and find airports that have places to eat. If you want to contribute to this growing database, there's a link you can click, and it takes you to a page where you can fill in some simple information, such as the airport. The airport identifier is good because sometimes there's more than one airport with the same name, so that's helpful but not required. And there's places to put in the restaurants or the diner or whatever, as well as some free-form text maybe describing it. You can also put in other interesting attractions, let's say, at or really near the airport, primarily museums. People are coming up with some museums that are at airports that they want to note. So there's a way to do that as well. So when you submit an airport using that form, it doesn't populate the map right away. It'd be kind of nice if it did. Maybe there's some way to do that. If there is, I haven't figured that out yet. But what does happen is I get an email. Then I have to put in the newly added airport and restaurant manually. So in a sense, it's moderated, which is good. But there can be a delay. And hopefully I haven't created a monster that's going to be a real chore to maintain. It's a way to have fun. It's a way to support your local airports. So we've been getting lots of submissions already from some co-hosts, some friends, some folks in the Slack team. So have at it. Visit eatattheairport.com. If there's one near you where you can go for lunch or have a meal, then consider doing that. If you run across some airports that aren't in the list and you'd like to add them in, use that form and we'll get them in there pretty quickly, I hope. If you look at the map right now as I record this, there's kind of a cluster in the northeast, sort of the northeast seacoast, let's say, and there's some in the southwest. There's some clusters there as well. So you can tell the folks who have been submitting. So encourage you to do that. Have fun with it, and we'll let you know how it works out. Hopefully it's something that encourages people to go eat at the airport. Launchpad Merzari is back, this time talking with Captain Skip Lucier. He is the pilot, the Navy pilot, who flew President George W. Bush in an S-3 to the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln. That was for a televised address back on May 1st, 2003.
Hey, Airplane Geeks listener. Your reporter-at-large, Launchpad Merzari, and I'm here with a really special guest.
Captain Skip Lucier, United States Navy, retired.
Whose call sign is Luce, and he has a unique perspective. He's the only person in naval history to use the call sign Navy One. Why is that?
Well, Launchpad, I was very fortunate when I was a commander to be the pilot that was selected to fly George W. Bush, the sitting president at the time, aboard the Abraham Lincoln to give a speech on the 1st of May, 2003.
Very cool. Okay, let's begin with some basics. Why you?
Well, I'd like to say it was some long and distinguished reason that I was chosen, but this was a classic case of being in the right place at the right time and fitting the suit. The criteria for the selection of the airplane and the aircrew was directed by the White House to be a pilot 05 and above who was on board the USS Abraham Lincoln, who participated in Operation Iraqi Freedom. And I was the only 05 pilot that flew the S-3 on the ship at the time.
Why the S-3? Why not one of those pointy-looking jets that get all the sex appeal and movies made about them?
I think that they were very concerned from a optic perspective not to have this as a showboating opportunity. I think the Navy would have loved to have put him in a Super Hornet, which was our brand new, you know, Rolls-Royce of airplanes. But the S-3 has a very good safety record. It was able to carry the right number of people, and it just had the it was the better choice for a transit from shore to ship. I think the other reason why it was chosen was there was a little bit of history there. Vice President Cheney had actually flown in an S-3 out to an aircraft carrier when he was the Secretary of Defense. And so when they were making the discussions, he was had that reference point of using that airplane to get out to the ship.
Well, did the Secret Service get a vote in this?
They were absolutely against the whole operation, I think. In fact, I was warned several times not to mention anything about any of the risks involved, or indicated all that the president would actually manipulate the controls of the airplane, which is possible in the S-3 because it's a dual cockpit, dual piloted platform when it was originally designed. So, they were definitely against it, and they had said they had to be in the airplane and have 24/7 visibility of the president throughout the operation.
Well, that kind of limits us to the COD and the S-3 then, right?
Yeah, they had two other CODs that were involved in it, but they were carrying Condoleezza Rice and the media out to the ship for the speech. But I really think that as a aviator himself, the opportunity to fly out into a jet and land on the ship appealed to the president and his team.
All right. And now you weren't the commander, right, of the squadron?
No, I was the second in command. I was the executive officer at the time. The way the Navy traditionally has our squadron set up is if the airplane has, or if the squadron has both pilots and naval flight officers flying the airplane, we alternate at the leadership position. So the commanding officer was actually a naval flight officer, and I was the second in command naval aviator.
So that speaks to kind of a fairness and equal opportunity in the Navy, is that, you don't have to be the pilot to be the commander of a naval squadron.
We broke that code a long time ago. It was actually a very good balance to have, the flight officers who are trained in different skill sets, running the weapon systems, but they can still lead and manage people just as good as pilots. So the Navy's been doing it for a long time.
Okay, so you take two aircraft and get to leave early and fly back to...
Yeah, we actually flew back to Naval Air Station North Island in San Diego, where our home base is, and that's also where the aircraft carrier was making its first port of call after the 10-month deployment to Operation Iraqi Freedom.
So you arrive, you had to be vetted, and then you arrive a day early, I take it?
Well, actually, I got to go in a little bit sooner than that. It was an interesting way that I found out that I was going to be the pilot. We were pulling into Hawaii about 5 days before the actual flight, and the Pacific Fleet Commander was coming out to the ship to congratulate the crew and thank us for our hard work in the war. And he said, "Hey, I got great news for you. The president's coming out to give a speech on your ship, and he's coming out in an S-3. And I was in the hangar bay with my CO next to me, and I said, "Tunes, did you know about that?" He said, "No, I didn't know about that." And then he said, "Wonder who the pilot is." I said, "Well, it's going to be me." I pretty much figured it was that was going to be the choice. So I actually flew home from Hawaii that day. I got told, "Pack your bags," because they, from a risk management perspective, they said, "We don't want this guy flying the leader of the free world out to the carrier after not seeing his family for 10 months. So we're going to get him back to San Diego a little early,
so that he can focus on the mission and not be, late getting onto the aircraft."
Yeah, when I called my wife and said I was flying back, she said, "What, did you get fired?" I said, "No, honey, it's all good. I'll tell you when we land." And then, of course, when I got to San Diego and I said, on Thursday, I'm going to fly the president out the ship, but you can't tell anybody. That was the worst kept secret in San Diego.
A lesson in OPSEC.
Yeah, she didn't have to bother with that one. She was pretty excited and made sure that anybody that was going to be watching the television that day knew to do it.
Well, let's get into that day. So you come in, and walk us through meeting the president, and he comes in early, I take it?
Yeah, so these things were fairly scripted, and, the president was flying in Air Force One, and And it says, you know, President lands in Air Force One at 11 o'clock. President gets off airplane at 11:01. President goes into base ops building at 11:05, gets into a flight suit. And at 11:10, we get into the S-3 and fly away. And of course, when we were having these discussions, I tried to point out that we really needed some time as a crew to get our act together. So they kept building in more and more time. So by the time the actual day occurred, we had about a 20 to 25 minute window where we could do a safety flight and crew brief with just the president and the Secret Service agent. And my naval flight officer, who also flew in the airplane, Ryan Wilson Phillips, we got an opportunity to have a crew brief with the president, which was probably the most special moment prior to the flight. So we basically, president got off, Air Force One lands and it's beak to beak with my little S-3. And it was pretty neat pictures that we got showing the 747 and parked in front of the airplane there. And the president waves to the crowd and Wilson nudges me and says, "Well, XO, there's no backing out now." You know, so down comes the president and he walks into the base ops building and goes, "Where's my pilot?" And from there, it was just like we were back in flight school.
You just caused me to think of something. By definition, the S-3 is a two-pilot aircraft. Was there some waivers or some rules that had to be waived to put a non-rated pilot in the right seat?
No, because the community actually, the airplane started flying in 1974, originally designed as a two-pilot airplane because of the length of missions. You wanted to have the redundancy of having another pilot in there. But as the service life of the airplane continued, we found more and more that you can fly that airplane with a single seat. And having another naval flight officer in the airplane helped manage the weapon systems better because you can do that from the front right seat as well. The way the cockpit was designed, you can run pretty much all of the radar and weapons from the front right seat. So about late 1988 or so, we were single piloted through the rest of my career.
Oh, okay. I was just worried that you might have to, there's switches that you might have that can only be reached if there's a co-pilot or something like that. So, all right.
No, it was pretty well designed, and if anybody could waive it, I think the president could.
Oh, that's it. But that's what I was thinking. Like, yeah, we're gonna. I need a memo put out somewhere. But okay, so we've legally got him, and you're doing pre-flight with the doing the crew brief. Then we go out to we're gonna walk out to the aircraft.
Yeah, so, one thing I'd like to mention about the crew brief is, I had the opportunity to put in a little bit of risk management conversation there. And I said, Mr. President, 99.9% of the time, everything goes really smoothly in naval air. But there's always that 0.01% chance. He goes, "Luce, you don't need to worry about that. We got a great vice president," which, pretty much caused us to bust a gut there. And I said, "Well, if you're not worried, I'm not worried." And then we were able to walk out to the airplane from there. And it was kind of neat. It was like a rock star, another squadron, our sister squadron from the Shamrocks, a BS-41, actually pre-flighted the airplane, started it, taxied it over. So all I had to do was hot seat into the plane and get ready to go with the president.
Didn't you get a pre-takeoff scare? You mentioned that earlier.
I would call it a scare. It became a little bit of an EP trainer. We're, a flight of two, and we're getting ready to take off down the runway. And As we're rolling down the runway, my number one generator started cycling off and on. And I also looked over and I noticed that the president's helmet, there's a little amplifier with a two-prong adapter in it that had come undone. So I pretty much knew at that point he really couldn't hear what I was saying. And then as I rotated the airplane, because of the number one generator was cycling, the landing gear was also connected to that number one bus. And they didn't want to raise. So I said, "Okay, well, which emergency do I handle first? We have an auxiliary power unit that I started up. I pulled the number one generator off. I started the power unit. I reached over and I'm trying to put the pronged back into the amplifier. And then I would go to raise the gear and I pressed the override switch and the gear came up. And my wingman called me on the radios and said, "Gear," because he was already clean coming up pretty fast. So we really had to get the gear up or else he would have underrun me.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, for a few seconds, I thought about turning downwind, but that wouldn't have played out very well, and it really was a pretty minor emergency, which happens, in an airplane that we were trained to take care of. So no big deal. We flew out and leveled off at about 5,000 feet and headed out to the Abraham Lincoln.
Now, let's leading question. What did the Navy and the White House tell you the rules for flying would be?
They said in absolutely clear terms that the president was not to touch the controls of the airplane.
Ooh.
So,
okay, what happened 3 minutes after gear was up?
Well, I pretty much knew that the president wanted to fly. And as soon as we were level and up, I said, Mr. President, you want to take control? He goes, why, sure I do. And, of course, we had the Secret Service agent in the back seat. And I know he was looking forward to the opportunity of showing the Secret Service agent what a great pilot was. So he takes control of the airplane and says, all right, Eddie, I got the controls. Don't get nervous. And he shakes the airplane around real violently. He goes, oh, Eddie, I'm a little off altitude, bumps the nose over, and we all go light in our seats. And I think he just enjoyed yanking the guy's chain all the way out to the ship.
That's awesome. The revenge of the president on the Secret Service.
And it was funny, you know, the Secret Service absolutely loved Bush. I didn't know how other Secret Service agents felt about serving presidents, but they really appreciated how well the president treated them and understood their mission that they'd take a bullet for him.
Okay, so we're flying out. The president's getting to do a big majority of the flying.
Yeah, so we're flying out there, and one of the decisions as we were doing the flight was that the airplane was going to land second. And so at some point we needed to change leads with my wingman, and the other airplane had one of our best pilots, Rocky Baker, and Z-Man Zellum, and it had Andrew Card, the chief of staff, and also the White House aide, Huff Huffington, who was carrying the football with the Nuke codes out to the ship. So they took the lead, and the president was actually flying formation off the S-3 as we did the flyby of the carrier and then went into the recovery pattern, went into the break.
Well, since you just mentioned who was flying as your wingman, who else was in the aircraft with you?
So it was myself, President Bush, Eddie, Secret Service agent. I still don't think I know his last name. And Ryan Wilson Phillips, who was our number one lieutenant at the time and was chosen to go on the flight. And then the other airplane, they said Rocky Baker, lieutenant, one of our best pilots, and Z-Man Zellum, lieutenant commander, flight officer, who was one of our department heads on board the squadron there. One thing I would like to mention, less than 14 months later, we lost Z-Man in an unfortunate accident, along with three other members of my squadron, Pup, Patty, and Showtime. I just want to make sure that they're not forgotten.
Yeah, because while naval aviation is exciting, sometimes there is a price to pay.
Yeah, and these guys paid the ultimate sacrifice, and we miss them to this day.
Well, let's get back to when we last left our hero. That's you. You're sitting there.
Use that tune very loosely.
Well, that is your call sign. So you're sitting there just with nothing to do because the president's doing all the flying chase to another aircraft. Walk us through having to put yourself in the pattern and waiting for call the ball.
Well, the president was flying and he really enjoyed it. As soon as we got to the ship, though, I took over so that he could enjoy the view. And that's the nice thing about the S-3 is we've got a really large cockpit window. And when we flew by the Lincoln and we were going about as fast as an S-3 could go, about 450 knots, and we looked down, I've never seen so many people on the flight deck. It was just clobbered with people. You could just see them everywhere. So they're having to get everybody ready for the recovery. And we came back around, and you come into the break about 800 feet and 450 knots. And Rocky Baker, like I said, excellent pilot, decided that he was going to break before the ship, which we call the round down. And so he broke. And by the time I broke, I was just over the top of the ship. And he landed, and then I landed. And thank goodness we stopped. I don't think that I would have been the butt of a lot of jokes for the rest of my life if I had missed the wires on the flight deck.
All right, let's talk about that. The number one plane has landed. Excuse me, your wing. The number two plane has landed first, and they taxi him away. You land, but then there's a ballet that's been choreographed. Walk us through that.
So one of the things that I learned very quickly was, you know, none of this stuff is done without the optic and the public affairs and having their spin. And what they didn't want is the president to be seen as showboating. And they also were very conscious of the negative press that Michael Dukakis got when he put a tank helmet on back and when he was running for president in the 80s. So the cockpit of the S-3, the cabin door, you go in and out only one way. And they were very concerned about a picture of the president's ass as he was coming out of the airplane. So when we landed in the carrier,
have to get out of the airplane butt first.
That's correct. And so what they decided to do, normally we would take a right turn out of the landing area, but this time we did a left 180 so that the crew door was looking towards the water away from the media, and it prevented any pictures that could have been construed or played with after the flight. So that was one unique opportunity or difference in the way that the normal carrier operations were done for the president's flight.
All right. Now, you've turned the plane 180 degrees so the door is facing the ocean, and you shut down. They're going to chain you down right then and there?
They did. They shut us down right there, and they had what they call them, the rainbow side boys. So they set up a reception for the president to walk through a honor guard of flight deck personnel that were dressed in all the different colors of the flight deck, you know, green jerseys, red jerseys, yellow jerseys. And then the admiral and the captain of the ship and the air wing commander were going to greet him. So we parked the plane and we had the opportunity to shut down right there in the landing area. The other thing they told me is they said, hey, make sure the president takes his flight gear off, because it goes back to that, you know, not wanting him look like the Dukakis and the tank helmet. So he goes, no, I feel pretty good. I think I'm going to keep it on. So I said, well, you're the president. You keep the flight gear on. So, you know, that was his choice. And he got out of the airplane and he looked pretty good.
But this 5-minute scripted walk didn't work out, did it?
No, because, you know, I can remember this when, you know, the president was supposed to get out. He's supposed to wave to the press, go through the side boys and meet the admiral. And we were just supposed to stay out of the shadows there. And he gets in front of the airplane. He goes, hey, Luce Wilson, come on over. And we get out in front of the jet and he's waving to the press. And he turns to me and he shakes my hand. He goes, son, you're on national television, which, you know, just set a chill through me. And then he the next thing we know is on a tradition on the carriers, you get bonged aboard. So they said, bong, bong, United States arriving. And, you know, at that point, everybody stood at attention, and the president went through the side boys and then met the leadership. He was supposed to stay on the flight deck for about 5 minutes and then head below, but he ended up on the flight deck for about 45 minutes, and he started shaking hands with all the air crew and all of the maintainers and the orderlies and the purple shirts and the yellow shirts and the green shirts. You could hear them just really excited. I think that if there's one place that you can let the president go and feel safe, it's in the hands of a bunch of Navy personnel. So they just let it happen. And I'm sure there's some fantastic pictures to this day that are mugging with the president on the flight deck of the Lincoln.
That's cool. And I'm sure he just decided that, you know, hey, I want to enjoy my life for a moment.
You know, the first sitting president to trap aboard an aircraft carrier, he certainly deserved it.
Then he gives a speech. You get to fly him off?
No. So what ended up happening was, is, you know, when a ship pulls in after a deployment, they pretty much want all the airplanes off before the ship goes pier side. So that afternoon, I flew off back to North Island along with all the other fighters and prowlers and E-2s. The air wing basically conducted its fly off that afternoon. And then this president spent the night on the ship. And the next morning, Marine One came out and picked him up because he was very concerned too. He didn't want to take away from the homecoming. So he wanted to be out of the picture by the time the ship went pier side, because he knew there were a lot of families ready to see the sailors who had been gone for so long.
You said Marine One went and got him. Why not Marine One onto the aircraft carrier?
Well, the plan at the time was that the ship was going to be further off the coast than the standard operating procedures of Marine One would allow. They had a limit of 50 nautical miles short of ship, and the ship was supposed to be further off the coast. So that's why the idea of a fixed wing plane to ferry the president out to the ship was determined. It turns out the ship made a little bit better headway and was closer than 50 miles by the time we did the flight. But at that point, there was no change. And I think the president really wanted the opportunity to get out there as quickly as possible, and the S-3 was the best way to do it.
So where is your S-3?
Well, after, one of the things about the S-3 community is we were in what they call a sundown, and squadrons were starting to be decommissioned, and airplanes were starting to be retired. The decision was made because of the significance of the airplane that they were going to induct it in the Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, Florida. So the Commodore of the S-3 Viking community ended up flying the airplane out a couple months later in July of 2003, and the plane's been there ever since.
And it has, now, unfortunately for the optics of it, they painted President Bush's name on both sides of the canopy rail of the aircraft, along with the green one.
That's the privilege of the president. You don't share the limelight on the canopy, but Airman Stiles did have his name on the nose gear still, so that was pretty good for him. I did get the opportunity to engrave my name in a Sharpie on the ejection seat just to have my name in there for posterity.
Oh, good for you. That's it. That's cool. And have you seen the aircraft since it's been enshrined?
I have. I was out there just a couple years ago. As a matter of fact, as we're going through the museum, of course, the tour guide found out that I was the pilot. And when we got to the airplane, he gave me the microphone and asked me to regale the crowd with a similar story as to what I've told you. So I got to do something similar as I'm doing here today on Airplane Geek in front of a small crowd at the Naval Aviation Museum.
Oh, very cool. Well, Luz, where are you now and what's next for you?
Well, I'm still, I guess I went to the dark side. I became a Department of the Army civilian after I retired after nearly 30 years as a naval officer. And I've been working at U.S. Africa Command. I've got a little more time here. We have a 5-year commitment overseas, and then I'll be heading back to the States looking for the next opportunity.
And full disclosure, that's how you and I met when we were both assigned to the United States Africa Command.
That's correct, but you were lucky. You were still flying stuff at that point. I was just flying a desk.
Yeah, that was I enjoyed that much, going into staff meetings and going, okay, who put time in their logbook today? All right, all you non-qualified pilots to the back of the room, even though I only had like 100 hours and you guys had thousands of hours.
I like to say I'm no longer pushing the envelope. I'm licking it.
I like that. Okay, well, this has been a real special time, and I want to thank you, Luz, for taking the time out to meet with us.
Oh, I just want to say, like I said, this is an opportunity to let all those people that ever flew or worked on the S-3 Viking, that it contributed significantly to national security and was a great airplane, and it still warms the hearts of many folks that the president chose it to go out to the ship.
Well, again, thank you, Luz. Airplane Geeks listeners, this is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Now, Dave Homewood from the Wings Over New Zealand show brings us a history segment on the de Havilland Mosquito.
Hello, Airplane Geeks. It's Dave Homewood here from the Wings Over New Zealand show. I hope that if I mention the name de Havilland Mosquito, that most of the listeners will have some idea of what I'm talking about. The Mosquito was affectionately known as the Wooden Wonder because its fuselage and wings were constructed from spruce and balsa wood. People get fixated on the first word, wooden. Sure, it's constructed from wood, but so were many other aeroplanes up to and during the time that the Mosquito was in service. The designer, Geoffrey de Havilland, went for wooden construction because he was aware that many of the metals then being used to build bombers and fighters were in high demand and short supply. Plus, his company had always produced wooden aeroplanes, trainers, tourers, bombers, race planes, etc. in the past. So why not wood in a modern design in 1940? It made sense. And whilst people fixate on its wooden construction, most tend to overlook the fact that a significant proportion of the aeroplane is indeed metal. The engines, the tanks, the wheels, the undercarriage, tubes and rods, and 100,000 screws and other fittings throughout each Mosquito. But whatever the construction, it became a legend. Designed initially as a bomber that could fly high and very fast, outrunning the enemy fighters, it proved its work in this role quickly. But it was also developed pretty quickly into a photo reconnaissance platform, one of the best of the war, and then into a fighter bomber that could attack and strafe targets and take on enemy fighters too. They also fitted it with rockets or torpedoes, or in some cases a massive big gun in the nose, and became a ship buster with coastal command. And they also became nighttime and daytime intruder fighters, often following enemy aircraft back to their aerodrome, joining the circuit and shooting up anything that was in the air or on the ground. Some Mosquitoes even became high-speed VIP transports with a special cabin in the bomb bay for passengers. They would cross into neutral Sweden and back, and sometimes they would be carrying shipments of much-needed ball bearings from that part of the world. And of course, the Mosquito became ubiquitous with the Pathfinder squadrons of RAF Bomber Command, including with the elite Oboe squadrons, which pinpointed the targets and dropped flares for the main force to follow. And Mosquitoes even served with the famous No. 617 squadron after the dams raid, though. The Mosquito had speed, it had long range, and it could pack a real punch to take it to the enemy. It basically did everything, and it exceeded in every role. It served over Britain and Europe, and also in India and Burma, Australia, the Pacific, Canada, and beyond, all around the world during the war. And after the war, many air forces continued to use the Mosquito well into the 1950s, despite the jet age eclipsing most of the World War II types. Here in New Zealand during World War II, many hundreds of pilots, navigators, observers and radar operators had served on the Mosquitoes within the RAF. There had been three New Zealand squadrons in Britain that flew them. Number 487 Squadron, famous for its low-level pinpoint daylight and nighttime bombing raids, including the famous Amiens prison raid. And Number 488 Night Fighter Squadron prowled the darkness over southern Britain, the English Channel and Europe, hunting for the Luftwaffe. And there was Number 489 New Zealand Squadron that flew Mosquitoes with rockets and torpedoes in the anti-shipping strikes along the occupied coast. After the war, the New Zealand government was made a very good offer to purchase Mosquitoes cheaply by the British government, who were downscaling the RAF. And between 1946 and 1948, a total of 80 new and slightly used Mosquitoes were flown from Britain, and a few of them were trainers that came just across from Australia, to New Zealand. Number 75 Squadron reformed in New Zealand around Mosquitoes. And whilst around 20 of those aircraft served on the squadron, the other 60 or so were simply stored until the mid-1950s, when they were no longer needed, as Vampires had replaced the fleet. At that point, they were all disposed of. Most were sold to scrap dealers, and one such entrepreneur was Harry Rolfe, who purchased at least a dozen of them. He intended to get them flying and sell them off overseas. His son Bill Rolfe was an RNZAF engineer who had actually worked on them in the Air Force, and so he came on board to help his father get them flying. He worked on the first example, which was numbered PZ-474, bringing it back up to an airworthy state and registering it on the New Zealand Civil Register as ZK-BCV. Several others also went on the register, but when PZ-474 was ready to go overseas, it was switched to the US register and got an N number. This was done just in time because the government here got wind that they were not going where they'd been told, and instead they were heading to a less savoury buyer. So all the other Mosquitoes had their registrations cancelled and restrictions put on their movement, which eventually led to their demise as they were chopped up for scrap. But PZ-474 did escape because it was on the US register and the New Zealand government could do nothing about it. It went off to the USA and onto an interesting career there before ending its days at Chino, where it eventually fell apart as its woodwork rotted away, while it sat there for an ownership dispute to be settled. Fast forward to the late 1990s, and I was invited by my father to go with him to a Royal Aeronautical Society bus trip to Auckland. One of the stops was in a boat building yard in East Tamaki, and there we visited a shed where a little known bloke was working on a little known project at the time. His name was Glyn Powell, and he was plodding away on building the molds to help rebuild a mosquito. Many years before that, a man named Owen Fenner, a member of New Zealand Warbirds Association, had suggested to his fellow warbirds enthusiasts that they should pull together their talents and money and rebuild a mosquito and get one flying. Around a dozen of them were enthusiastic, and the project was started. But over time, one by one, most of them went off in other directions until it was just Glyn, one of the original group, still trying to make it happen. On that visit, I think it was 1997, I learned a lot about the construction of the fuselage and how it was made in two halves with laminated wood over moulds, and they were joined together to form the hollow body. I was impressed with his dedication and his knowledge, but came away wondering if we'd ever get to hear anything more come of it. Well, a few years later, in 2005, I visited Glyn's workshop again with two friends who were visiting from overseas, John Parker and Steve Patterson. He'd now moved to a dedicated facility in Drury Hills, and he'd very recently joined the first fuselage that had come off the mould as a test piece. Incidentally, that fuselage is now in Canada at a museum, and an aircraft is being rebuilt using it. By that stage, I had a lot more confidence in his project, and it was certainly moving forward. He then did a second fuselage off the mould, which was for his own project. And I think it was around 2007. I was then invited by my friend Kerry Carlisle to come along to meet some guys at Ardmore who were working on a mosquito project. And this was the guys at Avspex. They had just taken possession of a fuselage, the third one off the moulds, and the project was for Jerry Yagan and was going to be used to rebuild KA114. I, of course, at the time met Warren Denham, who runs Avspex, and quite a few of the team, and my visits to Avspex became more regular. I was actually getting more and more interested in the mosquito, and over time and over the years, I was seeing this aircraft come together. I got to know the team and got to see what amazing work they were doing. So fast forward again, we get to 2012, and I think it was September 27th, I was there the day that KA114 took flight, becoming the first mosquito to ever be rebuilt from the ground up in the world, and becoming the only flying mosquito for 16 years as the last flying one who crashed in England. And it was absolutely magnificent. And 2 days later, there was a big air show, a really big air show. It wasn't meant to be a big air show, but so many people turned out for it. It was massive. And that aircraft performed at its first air show 2 days after it first flew. It was brilliant. And the pilots were magnificent. Dave Phillips and Keith Skilling, both amazing pilots, amazing guys, wonderful guys. And for that air show, I'd been asked to get together as many of the veterans who had worked on the mosquito, flew them or were ground crew on them during World War II or post-war in the 1950s. And I managed to find about 35 of them, and a few of them came from overseas for it. And we had an amazing banquet dinner that night with 400 people in the hangar with these mosquito veterans as the special guests. And it was just absolutely fantastic and an amazing time. And that aircraft eventually did a few air shows in New Zealand, finishing at Wings Over Wairarapa with an amazing finale display by Dave Phillips that had everybody in the crowd, the massive crowd, were just wiping tears. It was just the best display you've ever seen. And then was crated up and went off to the USA, and it's been flying with Jerry's collection at Virginia Beach ever since. And by the time that that aircraft flew, they were already working on the next one, which was for Paul Allen. And that aircraft, of course, flew 2 years ago and is now in the USA, based at Payne Field in Washington State, with the late Paul Allen's collection. And by the time that one had flown, they were working on the next one, which is now just about to fly as well. And that aircraft is, oh, it's just even better than the last two. It's I've watched all three of them come together, and this one I'm so looking forward to seeing fly because the detail on it is even better, and it's come out in a different color scheme again. It's in a Coastal Command color scheme, which is so rare on any warbirds or even museum aircraft to remember RAF Coastal Command, and it just looks fantastic. And in November, I saw it running its engines at the Warbirds Open Day, and that just brought back all the memories of KA114 when I was seeing it doing its engine runs just before its flight. We're all looking forward to seeing it take to the air again, probably in January 2019. I just want to say a huge shout out to all of the people along the way who have been involved in rejuvenating the Mosquito. Is probably the most important of all the aircraft of the war. People get fixated on the Mustang or the Spitfire or the Lancaster or the B-17, but what they don't realize is the Mosquito did it all and more. And, you know, it had the range to get to Berlin. It had everything. And it really was an amazing aircraft. So, and it seems to be, it did get largely forgotten, and thanks to the guys at AvSpecs and Mosquito Aircraft Restoration Limited, which is Glynn's company, they're now fully back in the public awareness, and that's fantastic. So all of you listeners right across the USA, go and have a look at the Mosquitoes if you get a chance. There's going to be three of them there soon because this one's going to Texas. PA-474, it's that same one that left New Zealand back in the 1950s. It went all the way to USA to come back, and it's been restored. And that is fantastic because it has genuine Royal New Zealand Air Force history. And I just can't recommend more the Mosquito. It is just fabulous, fabulous aircraft. So make sure you go and have a look. And once again, a huge congratulations to Glynn's team and to Warren's team. Together, you've rebuilt, you've restored three amazing aircraft, and there's more to come as well down the track. And it's history that needs to be told, and it will now be told in the best possible way by seeing them flying. So I just want to close by wishing everybody a very happy new year for 2019. And sometime during the new year, I hope that a lot of you will get to see a Mosquito flying, whether you're in New Zealand or whether you're in the USA. And to the Airplane Geeks team, keep up the great work.
Thanks, Dave. Now, our own David. David Vanderhoof attended the celebration for the 15th anniversary of the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center. That, of course, is the companion facility to the museum on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Now, David recorded the interview with Dr. Ellen Stofan, the new John and Adrienne Mars director at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. She was interviewed by Pete Montine. He's a certified flight instructor, also a television news reporter for WUSA-9 in Washington, D.C. Here's the recording used with permission.
Brown, I serve as a deputy director of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the 15th anniversary of this center, which is, in its own right, one of the most popular museums in the world. When the Udvar-Hazy Center opened 15 years ago, it boasted iconic aircraft like the SR-71, the Concorde, the Clipper Flying Cloud, and others. And we welcomed the Space Shuttle Discovery in 2012 and continue to add milestone aircraft and objects to this day. What do the next 15 years have in store? Our director, Dr. Ellen Stofan, is here to give us an idea. She's been with the museum for 8 months, and we're excited to hear more about her background, experiences with the museum so far, and her vision for the future. Interviewing her today is our friend Pete Montine. Pete is a graduate of the University of Maryland's Philip Merrill College of Journalism. After 6 years covering the state capitol in Pennsylvania, he joined the team at USA 9 in 2016. Pete is a third-generation pilot, having been taught by his mother, Nancy Lynn. He regularly competes in aerobatic aircraft and flying competitions similar to aircraft like the ones you see here today, and is now an instructor helping to train the next generation of aviators and explorers. Please join me in welcoming Ellen and Pete. How do you feel about today? 15 years is a big milestone. What do you think about it? How do you feel?
You know, this is such an exciting day for the museum because all of us at the Air and Space Museum, this place has a really special place in our hearts because, as all of you know who are here today, this place is amazing. And if anything, it is under-visited compared to the museum downtown. Downtown, we get about 6 to 8 million visitors a year. Here, we get about 1.5 million visitors a year. And I always feel like those, you know, 5 million people that are visiting our museum downtown are so missing out by not coming here. You know, this place is awe-inspiring, you know, from the SR-71 to the space shuttle to everything else that we have out here. I think this place is magical, and so to know that it's 15 years old, 15 years of success, over 20 million people through the doors of this building, we're all incredibly proud. I'm incredibly proud of the staff who made this place happen.
Can you tell me about the first time that you came here?
You know, the first time I came here was not that long after it had opened, and I just remember being amazed by it because just thinking, where did all these aircraft come from? Because I had been to the museum downtown since not that long after it opened, and so to come here and realize that all of these aircraft had been basically in storage, and I will say, at that point, I didn't know anything about our Paul E. Garber facility in Silver Hill, Maryland, which is where a lot of these aircraft were stored prior to that time. Of course, there were a lot of aircraft also that were brought in when we opened the facility that we didn't have before, like the SR-71, and of course, Discovery, that was doing a little bit of work until it came here.
Can you tell me about your favorite moment sort of in the history of time? You've only been here 8 months, but in 15 years here, sort of considering the history of the HASI Center, do you have a moment that really sticks out for you? I think, seeing as though you were chief scientist at NASA, I kind of know your answer, but I'm not exactly sure.
Well, I'm not sure if people are really aware of the fact that when NASA went to retire the shuttles, you know, we already had the Enterprise at the Smithsonian, and there was an intense competition among museums and science centers all across the country as to who was going to get the shuttles. And of course, being the country's premier air and space museum, being the third most visited museum in the world after a museum in Beijing and the Louvre, of course, the National Air and Space Museum had to have an actual space shuttle. And so to me, in 2012, when Discovery, as I like to say, Discovery came home to Udvar Hazy, that was really a special moment. And I was actually living in the UK at the time, so I wasn't even here. But when I hear the stories of people who were here and saw that shuttle arriving, I'm really angry that I missed it because it sounds like, and it was an amazing day. But the ability that we all have, I worked on two shuttle missions I was down in Texas because I was at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and we were flying a radar instrument on the shuttle that was looking at the Earth. This was in 1994. And those two missions were actually Atlantis and Endeavour. And Tom Jones, the astronaut who's frequently here signing books, he flew on both those missions. And so when you see a shuttle and you understand, that thing went to space. You know, it was in space, not just once, but a bunch of times. The Discovery launched the Hubble Space Telescope, which has changed humanity, changed how we look at the universe. that thing is incredible. You know, when you look at it, you should just get goosebumps, because I do.
I think the coolest thing about the Air and Space Museum is how formative it is for so many. Like, I remember coming to the museum on the Mall as a three-year-old, and it's interesting to listen to other interviews with you and hear your background as a scientist and a planetary geologist, and you were an intern at essentially the National Air and Space Museum in college. Can you sort of tell us a bit about your background with the museum in sort of your previous life and sort of leading up to this moment, and how did you get into science too?
Well, you know, my dad worked for NASA, and in fact, the rocket that he worked on a lot was an uncrewed rocket called the Titan Centaur, and there's actually a model of it in the back of the space hangar, which I didn't realize until I was actually doing an interview, and I walked up to it and was like, oh my gosh, that's my dad's rocket! So the model is back in the corner, and so I went to most of the launches. That rocket launched the Voyagers. Voyager 2 just left the solar system. How crazy is that? And I actually saw both of them launch down in Florida. Another thing, you can see I get goosebumps a lot, but I mean, that was just so incredible to see. I saw these things launched, and now they're both outside the solar system. So when I was a kid growing up, because I went to launches and I was around NASA, you know, I got exposed to it, but it wasn't when I went to the Viking launches, I realized, like, oh, NASA sends spacecraft to planets and they do science. They're trying to understand Mars, understand the origins of life. And I thought, okay, that's what I want to do. But it was hard to look at NASA and think of it as a place where someone who looked like me could have a career, because all the people that I saw at NASA looked like my dad. But nevertheless, I sort of said, that's what I want to do. And so I went to graduate school. I worked on missions to Venus, missions to Mars, the Earth orbiting mission I was talking about, and the Cassini mission to Saturn. And I was chief scientist of NASA for a while. But most of what I did throughout my career is to look at the surfaces of other planets in the solar system, like Venus, like Mars. But it was always to try to understand, how does the Earth work? Because only having one planet to study makes it really hard to understand things like volcanoes. Like, why do we have earthquakes? You know, how does this planet change over time? How does our climate change over time? Having other planets to compare Earth to helps us understand this planet much better.
Talk about only seeing people who look like your dad in NASA. How does the museum sort of change its face to inspire young women, to inspire kids of varying backgrounds to get into careers? You talk a lot about STEM, science, technology, engineering, math. How does the museum sort of change its face to sort of bring more people into the fold?
You know, we have to tell all the stories. I think a lot of people were so inspired by Hidden Figures, the book by Margot Lee Shetterly, and then the movie that came out. But you know what? We should have known that story all along.
Right.
They should not have been Hidden Figures. And my thing is, when I was growing up, and I would look like, who are women scientists? And it was like, Marie Curie. And then it was Marie Curie. And like, okay, you know, Mary Leakey. You know, but there wasn't. And, you know, there were tons of women all along. There were people like Ada Lovelace, who helped actually invent computing. There were women astronomers. For example, Caroline Herschel was out there doing a lot of the work that her brother took all the credit for. And that we actually tell her story in the museum downtown. So my aim is to tell all the stories. And as I said, we already do that at the Air and Space Museum downtown. Again, we talk about Caroline Herschel, a key figure in early astronomy. We certainly show, we have a big case on Sally Ride. So we tell we have an exhibit on the Tuskegee Airmen and Bessie Coleman. So we have to tell all the stories. And we can't just tell them in one place. We have to tell them every place, all through the museum, so that every kid who walks in the museum says, someone like me can do, has done amazing things. I'm really excited, actually, later this week, we're going to be getting into this museum, Jackie Cochran, who was the first woman to break the speed of sound. We're getting her aircraft is actually coming into this museum. We need to show those artifacts, tell those stories, otherwise they'll remain hidden. Like, unfortunately, Katherine Johnson did for way, way, way too long.
I love talking to the museum staff because, like reporters, the people here are storytellers. And so you're just sort of trying to present the story in a different plane. I think what's so fascinating is that you're going through this big transformation right now on the National Mall. How does the story look newer and different on the National Mall? And how does HASI sort of play a role in that? It's going to be a long transfer until 2025.
Right, it's going to take us 7.5 years to repair the museum downtown. Unfortunately, the building is in really poor condition, so we basically have to almost rebuild it. So it's going to be done, think of it as sort of 2-3.5 year project. So starting in January, we close the west end of the museum. All those galleries will close. The east end will remain open. We'll work on that half for a little over 3 years. Then we'll reopen the western half, close the east half. That's a little bit of a simplification, but then we swap it around. So big involved project, long time, but what an opportunity to say, let's bring some artifacts out of storage that have not been displayed before. Let's bring some great aircraft that are good for the stories we want to tell that live here. We'll take them downtown. Let's take some of the items, artifacts from downtown that have been on display there for over 30 years. Let's bring them out here and put them display on here. So it gives us an opportunity. And as you said, it's all about the stories. And to me, those are stories of ideas that defy, whether it was a person who, you know, was going to invent something that someone told them was impossible, like the Wright brothers, when people thought, you know, people can't fly. Well, we proved that wrong. Stories about women like Bessie Coleman, who had to go to France to get a pilot's license. You know, people like the 400,000 people that worked on the Apollo program. Those are the stories we want to tell. And I think what you're going to see downtown as we renovate the museum, a lot more of a modern look, a lot of use of technology, a lot of storytelling, but also the iconic artifacts that define this place. Things like Neil Armstrong's suit, things like the Wright Flyer, the Spirit of St. Louis. So we're going to use those our iconic artifacts to tell these stories of what to me is American heroism, American ingenuity, American teamwork.
It sounds to me like, though, there's a bit more of a strengthened symbiosis between, not that there hasn't been before, between Yuval HASI and the National Mall. You kind of need to do a bit of shuffling around. You guys are looking forward to that.
We do, and we are looking forward to it. But one of the things, I'll be honest with you, we're still struggling with is, you know, for example, our World War II gallery downtown, where we have the opportunity, you know, to really maybe tell a better story than we do here. But look, the most amazing artifacts of World War II aviation that we have all sit over here. And so one of the things we're really thinking about is how do we use technology. First of all, to remind people that HASI's out, because there's nothing you can't replace actually coming here and standing over there and looking at those aircraft. But how do we use technology to bring what's here at HASI that we just can't fit downtown, so that people do get to experience both when we're trying to tell the stories? Because in a sense, you need all the aircraft to tell the whole story. But we're going to have to do some of it in person, some of it with technology.
Do you have a favorite artifact here?
The SR-71.
Yeah. Who wouldn't like it?
You know, people talk about STEM and STEAM, the A in STEM standing for the arts, you know, and a friend of mine always says, no, it should be STEAM, science, technology, engineering, arts, math, and design. And to me, there's no better artifact for STEAM than the SR-71. I mean, here it is. It made it from Los Angeles to the museum, breaking the record in 1 hour and 5 minutes when they delivered it here, 1 hour and 4 or 1 hour and 5 minutes. How many of us would not like to make it to Los Angeles in 1 hour and 4 minutes instead of the, 5 hours it takes to get across country? You know, so such an amazing piece of technology. Such an amazing story that the man who designed that, Kelly Johnson, was someone who had been designing aircraft for years and years, and we have a curator who's really told the story about Kelly Johnson and the Skunk Works. So amazing history behind it, amazing design. And then you look at it, and it just looks cool. And that's that design piece that I think is so appealing.
A lot of big events coming up for the National Air and Space Museum. You talked a bit about Apollo. The 50th anniversary is next year. You guys are already sort of celebrating that. Can you explain that to folks and how integral it is to do that on this anniversary?
Well, you know, as to date myself, I was 8 when Apollo 11 landed on the moon, and the 50th anniversary of that will be July 20th of next summer. And I think for those of us who did live through it, it's amazing to look back and think about what was accomplished. Here you had this young president who set a challenge to a nation of making it to the moon within a decade. And remember where we started from. We started from almost nothing. They had to build Kennedy Space Center. They had to build Johnson Space Center. They had to come up with math and technology that just didn't exist to get us to the moon. And yet they did it in 8.5 years. And we celebrated Apollo 7 in October. This past week, we celebrated Apollo 8, the 50th anniversary of which is actually next week or this coming week. So then between October of 68 and July of 69, we launched 5 missions in a 10-month period, each of which was doing something incredibly technologically challenging that had never been done before. And so what I'd like us to use this year ahead is to reflect on that. You know, what is a moonshot? How did we do that, again, as a nation, that 400,000 people, not just the astronauts that we think about? But I think that concept of a moonshot, which is almost a throwaway word now,
yeah.
People will be like, this is a moonshot in laundry detergent. And you're like, nope, nope, don't say that. so what does that mean? And what I really want is for us to think about what the next moonshot is. And for me, that's very much getting humans to Mars within the next 20 years. But for those who didn't see it by some chance, you can either go to the National Air and Space Museum website. You can go to NASA TV. It's going to be rebroadcast on December 24th. The last Tuesday night, just this past Tuesday night, we held an event at the National Cathedral where we had Bishop Michael Curry of the Episcopal Church, the administrator of NASA, and Jim Lovell spoke about Apollo 8. And I tell you, it was incredibly moving because Apollo 8, for many of us, really embodies, we say the spirit of Apollo, but it's this idea that of all the things I was just talking about. You know, we did this literally sort of last minute. It was only planned 4 months before. Apollo 8 was not supposed to go to the moon. It was supposed to be an Earth orbit test. They decided to go for the moon. Incredibly risky. They came around the side of the moon, took that iconic Earthrise image that totally changed, I would argue, humanity's perception of ourselves. So I love that mission. So again, if you didn't get to see us all talking about the emotion and the import behind that mission, NASA TV, Air and Space Museum website, it was called The Spirit of Apollo.
I'm going to tie this up with a bow because I'm going to take some audience questions. Can you tell me a bit about your vision for the next 15 years here at Hazen?
You know, I adore this place, and as I said, I'm clearly, like, my whole aim is how can we get more people here, but you know, this place also is an incredible opportunity. I have to tell you, we have more, some of these struts up here in the ceiling, I don't know what the proper word for them is, we can actually hang more aircraft from them. We can put more airplanes up there. So there's room to do that. This building was also, I have to tell you, built to be expanded. We still have hangars full of aircraft out at the Garber facility that we can't display because we literally have no room to display them. So we also have a classroom, which you can see back there, Claude Moore Educational Center. My aim is to really expand our educational programs out here. Our downtown museum, to me, is almost a little more of a tourist museum. While we certainly do a lot of work with the D.C. public schools, and we've been doing more, out here in Virginia, we are a community museum. We serve Loudoun County, Prince William County, Fairfax County. How can we expand those educational programs with our neighbors out here in Virginia? How can we show even more aircraft, tell even more stories? And then eventually, and my fundraising people don't want to hear this, remember, this building was built entirely with private funds. A lot of the restoration work downtown is being covered by government funds. We still have to raise the money to do all the exhibits inside the museum, but the building work downtown is being covered by the federal government. Out here, we raise the money for everything. So when I eventually expand this, it will be done with private funding. So as soon as we finish with downtown, we're going to be looking to see how can we make this place even bigger and even better. And I do want to give a plug for people who please stay this afternoon because Stephen Udvar-Hazy is going to be here. He's coming in a few hours. and we're going to be interviewing him. And he is the most amazing man, and his support of this place made it happen. It really is individual support, from $5 and $10 donations to $1,000 donations to multi-million-dollar donations that allow this place to exist and for us to tell these stories. So for those of you who aren't members of the National Air and Space Society, please join. And again, if you have time to stay around later this afternoon, come listen to Stephen Hazy, because he's truly an inspiring guy. Really wonderful.
When your name's on the building, you get a taxi right up to it.
Yeah.
That'll be awesome. We want to take some audience questions. We have about 10 minutes left. We're going to do this kind of in a low-tech way. I think we're close enough to shout-out questions, although if not, we have a microphone that Allison will gladly pass around. Does anyone have a question up here in the front?
And that's in this question, my the Apollo 15. They shut the Apollo exhibit down and the reconnaissance exhibit down at the downtown center. And I'm just curious, is that going to be that way during Apollo 50 as well?
Yeah. Unfortunately, the Apollo Gallery downtown has closed. It closed about a week ago. And while we're obviously sad that we had to close it for this 50th anniversary year, you know, that gallery was really tired. We needed to get the artifacts out of it in order to start restoring them, in order to have them ready for when we open the Destination Moon exhibit, which will open in 2021 and will be amazing. It will have the iconic F1 engines in it. It will also have some F1 engines that they got off the ocean floor will be in it. But we needed to get all the artifacts into the conservation lab and get them restored. We are going to have a special case downtown of Apollo artifacts that will come out, so there will be Apollo 11 artifacts that will be shown.
Armstrong suit, right?
And then Armstrong's suit, which has been in the conservation lab being worked on for quite some time now, that will come back out in July before the anniversary. And then, please, on the 20th of July, we're going to stay open all night. We're going to have a giant party that goes on all night long to celebrate the 20th anniversary, and we want to break all attendance records, so please come to that. Put it on your calendar.
I'm really lucky to have gotten to do a story about Neil Armstrong's suit and Aldrin's suit and saw it up close, and the coolest thing about it is that the moon dust is still
embedded
into the fibers of the spacesuit. It's really fascinating.
It really is, and you look at it, and it's like, it is. You look at it, you're like, oh, this is really dirty. Why didn't they clean this? And then you're like, oh, my God, it's got moon all over
right.
it. You know, you're not going to
It's not holding up well, yeah. No, it's the moon dust. Anyone else?
Yes, a suggestion. I wonder if you're familiar with the Maritime Museum in Amsterdam.
No, I'm not.
It, you must visit it. It has the most advanced and easy-to-use technology for communicating ideas.
Very cool.
One example, if you see a particular exhibit that you like, you can register when you come in, put your computer address in some sort of device. And if you see a particular display that you like, you can note it with a pressing button. And the information, the fuller information about that exhibit or that item is sent to your own computer.
That's very cool.
That is only just the beginning. Mm-hmm. You really should visit it.
No, I will. And plus, I love Amsterdam, so any excuse to go to Amsterdam.
The building is several hundred years old.
Oh, how cool. But they've done a great job. Yes. You know, and that's what we're really looking at. And part of, you know, to get you to understand some of the challenges we have, you know, parts of the museum aren't going to open until 2024. So we also worry about what might be, you know, cutting-edge technology.
Sure.
Now, we don't want it to be like, oh, in 2024, people come in and are like, oh, wow, this is so, like, late 2018, you know. So we're also struggling with how do we bring in technology as late in the process as we can to make sure that we're taking advantage of what is cutting edge and aren't dated.
I flew in 85-inch Sky Raiders back in the 50s. That was a very great airplane.
You know, we continue to collect aircraft. We are challenged right now in collecting large aircraft because we literally have nowhere to put them. In fact, we have a World War II plane, Shoo Baby, right now that is actually being held. It's World War II, isn't it, Peter? Peter's going to go now that far. Oh, we do? Oh, okay. We do have a Skyraider in the collection.
Will it be exhibited?
You know, right now we're still really, we haven't made the final decisions on what's going to be exhibited downtown, on how we will ultimately arrange this place post-2024. So we're still really looking at the entire collection. We're also thinking about the aircraft like Shoo 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 Baby that we want to bring into the collection that we just don't even have anywhere to put right now. So everything is sort of going like this right now.
It's an opportunity.
Yeah, it is. It is. And of course, now you see my frustration of saying we really would like to expand this place eventually because there's more that we have, and a lot of the aircraft we want to collect to bring us up through modern aviation and modern military aviation, they're all big.
It did serve well in the Vietnam War.
Well, it sounds like we have one. Thank you, Peter. That's Peter Jacob, my chief curator, who tells me what to say when I don't know what I'm talking about.
Hi, do you mind discussing more about your internship at the National Air and Space Museum? Like, some really important things that you gained from the experience?
Sure, and you know, I'm a huge fan of internships. When you're, for the younger people in the audience, as you go through college, internships to me are a really great way to sort of experience different careers and say, is this something that I would like or not? And for me, that internship was really pivotal because when I was 14, I was like, I'm going to become a planetary geologist. But, you know, frankly, I had no idea what a planetary geologist really did on a day-to-day basis. And that internship was the first one that I had where, you know, to be honest with you, Brad, I started as the summer intern. So I was literally taking photographs and filing them in the right book where they were supposed to go. So I wasn't actually doing anything that substantial. But as I stayed there across the summer, the man who ran the Center for Earth and Planetary Studies, which is on the top floor of the museum where our scientists are, he's a scientist called Farouk Elbaz, and he then became a huge mentor to me, which is another important thing about internships. And he came to see me just a couple weeks ago. And, you know, he stayed in touch with me across my career. And as I stayed there as an intern, he could see how interested I was. And I kept asking him questions. So he kept giving me slightly more complicated things to do besides filing photographs, which I guess they figured out I could do that. So they're like, all right, we'll give you something a little more complicated than that. See if you trip up. But it was just an amazing experience for me, and it really solidified my feeling that I'm on the right track. This is what I want to do, and I could have hated it. I mean, my husband, who I didn't know at the time, that same summer, he was doing an internship in a law firm because he thought that's what he wanted to do. And he said, like, it was the most painful, like, 6 weeks of his life. He's like, don't want to be a lawyer. So, I mean, it's really important. It's either going to be really positive or really negative. And that, you know, to me, you really have to follow your passion. Especially, you know, no matter what career you're in, you spend so much time doing that job. It's got to be something that you care about.
I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for talking to me. It was really fun. The museum is still open, obviously. Chris Brown is giving a talk on the F-14, which is over that way. Stephen Hase arrives pretty soon, so enjoy the day.
You can learn more about the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum at airandspace.si.edu. And, of course, we look forward to seeing many of you June 15th, 2019, at the annual Innovations in Flight Day at the Uvar Hazy Center. Keep listening to Airplane Geeks, and we'll be providing more information as we get closer to the date. Well, that's it for this Bits and Pieces episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we'll return to our usual format with aviation news, a great guest, and a lot more. Don't forget to visit the aviation events calendar at avgeekfests.com to find an aviation event in your area. And if you know of events that are not in the calendar, please submit them. And of course, feel free to share the avgeekfests.com link across your network. Also, have a look at eatattheairport.com. Let us know if you have any suggestions and submit some airports so others can eat at the airport. And as always, please help promote the Airplane Geeks podcast wherever you can, on social media, where you work, at your flying club, or whatever's appropriate. We'd be very grateful. And as always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/533. We encourage you to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. You can subscribe in Apple Podcasts on iOS, in Google Podcasts on Android, or through the podcast app that you use on your mobile device. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his music compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments,